When they weren't harvesting one of the fields, and nobody had a great need for fresh meat, James had begun going into the woods and cutting down trees to provide logs for the cabin he intended to build for himself and his sister Annie. It would be more than a mile upriver from Andrew and Petra, and fully a mile from the new cabin of cousin Frank and his family. James had gathered perhaps half enough for the job, cleaning them with branches with his sharp axe, dragging the logs up and stacking them at the place where he planned to build. He hadn't asked Annie's advice about the site. She would probably want to build somewhere else out of pure sisterly contrariness. He didn't see where it mattered anyway. She would probably snare some poor unsuspecting soul and leave here before long, properly married. Let somebody else try to please Annie. A time or two, his bay horse, Walker, looked off toward the timber as if he saw or smelled something. James glanced in that direction.
Probably a deer.
When he'd finished the day's work here, he would take his rifle and see about fetching some fresh venison for the table. He didn't see the three soldiers until too late. He was busy using the horse to drag a log out of the woods with the thick rawhide rope he had laboriously made for himself in the evenings after the field work was done. The bay horse jerked its head around, pricking its ears forward in alarm. Two soldiers were bearing down on James, spurring their horses viciously. A third, he looked like the sergeant, sat back. One of the soldiers waved a saber that blinked a split second of reflected sunlight. James felt his pulse quicken, and he looked around desperately for something with which to defend himself. He had left his long rifle leaning against the stack of logs. All he had was the axe, its blade buried into the log he was dragging. He grabbed it, wrenching it free. He gripped the handle in both hands and brought it up to catch the saber's savage downstroke. His wrist quivered at the impact as the sharp blade bit deeply into the hard wood. He thrust the axe upward, shoving the sword back toward the man who held it, then gave it a quick twist, trying to wrest the blade from the dark brown hand. It came free from the axe handle, but the soldier retained his grip on it. The second soldier had no saber, but he had a blunderbuss. James used the axe to shield himself from the second swing of the saber. James twisted the handle's end around and drove it with force against the soldier's ribs. James dropped the axe and grabbed the sword arm, giving the man a hard pull. The man landed atop his sword. The point of it drove into his leg. The other soldier brought up the blunderbuss. James stepped quickly behind the down soldier's horse. The animal went down, its thrashing hind legs striking the soldier who was on the ground. James saw that the man still on horseback was trying hard to reload the weapon. James picked up the axe and flung it in that direction. The horse spooked, causing the man to lose the gunpowder he'd poured in the palm of his hand for placement down the hot barrel. James made a quick dash across the open ground toward his own rifle. Grabbing it, he dodged behind the pile of logs and dropped down. He brought up the rifle, cocking the hammer back. He took a quick bead on the soldier still on horseback, but judgment stayed him from squeezing the trigger. If he fired, he would be defenseless during the moments he was reloading. That blunderbuss would almost surely get him. And if it missed, the sergeant had moved up closer with a weapon of his own. But this way, his rifle loaded, James remained a lethal threat to the horseman. The nearest soldier swung quickly to the ground and put his horse between James and himself. The matter went to a standstill for a minute or two. James watched the soldier over his sights, the rifle leaned against the top log of the stack. The soldier had his blunderbuss leveled across the seat of his saddle, though his nervous, fidgeting horse made it impossible for him to hold the barrel still. The soldier whose leg was cut crawled behind the downed horse, trying to use it for a shield from James's rifle. James's bay horse had spooked and dragged the log at the end of the rawhide rope until it caught against the others and wedged, stopping him beside the stack. James saw the sergeant's face. He was livid, but didn't move closer.
Son of a bitch is a coward. Send those other poor bastards to do the job.
He remembered Andrew's warnings about caution, about watching what he said and to whom he said it. Andrew had been right, but if the situation arose again, James knew he would do nothing differently. All his growing up years, he had remembered how sternly Michael had faced whatever challenges came along, and he had tried to follow that example. He might sometimes wish things would turn out in another way, but anybody waiting for him to apologize had better bring enough victuals for a long camp. At last, the soldier, still on his feet, began moving toward the one that was down, leading his horse, keeping the animal between him and James. The wounded man began crawling on hands and knees.
Put your gun down and I won't shoot you!
The soldiers didn't understand him. He tried a couple of times making motions as if to lay down his rifle, then pointing toward the blunderbuss. The message got through, finally. The soldier laid the weapon down at his feet, and James rested his across the stack of logs, in plain sight of the soldiers, but well within his reach if he needed it. He had no intention of letting sympathy for a wounded man jeopardize his own survival. They raised him smarter than that in Tennessee. The soldier who had held the rifle used a knife to cut away part of the other's trouser leg and bind it around the wound. Then he helped his wounded companion up into the saddle. The wounded man pointed toward his own saddle, still buckled to the dead horse. The second one struggled with the animal's weight and managed to worry the saddle loose and take the bridle. The soldier handed them to the wounded man to hold while he swung up behind him on the horse, the blunderbuss in his hand. The sergeant made no move to help them. He held his distance, sulking over their failure. James wondered how far they had to travel. The wounded one was going to have a mighty sore leg before they went many miles, and they'd have a very tired horse carrying double. The second soldier would probably have to get down and walk a right smart of the way. The sergeant probably wouldn't help them any more than he already had. The privilege of rank and the arrogance.
Well, to hell with them.
James hadn't invited them here. As the men rode away, the sergeant turned in his saddle.
¡Muero, usted cerdo insolente!
James wished he had a little Spanish of the right kind so he could make a proper reply. All he could do in the way of communication was to raise his rifle over his head and shake it. Three men, he had run them off. He wondered if Michael had ever done better than that. Trouble was, they might not stay run off. That sergeant looked like the kind of man who'd keep bringing more soldiers until he got the job done, no matter how many of them got hurt in the process.
This might be a good time to go hunting for a few days.
They wouldn't be back for a little while, at least. He had two or three more trees felled out in the edge of the wood. Be damned if he'd let a few soldiers stop him from getting a day's work done. He dragged the remaining trees in before he mounted the horse and rode eastward to let Andrew know what had happened. Andrew already had an inkling, because he rode out to meet James, his thin face dark with worry.
Are you all right?
Didn't nothing happen to me. It all happened to them.
Soldiers rolled by the field, two of them on one horse, and one of them looking like he was bad hurt. I tried to ask him what happened, but all I got was a cussing out by that sergeant. Oh, I was afraid I'd find you laying up here dead someplace. You oughtn't have shot a soldier.
I didn't. That soldier fell on his own damn sword, bled like a stuck hog. Gonna be a while before he gives anybody much trouble.
Well, there's a plenty more where he came from. What happened?
They just come at me out of the woods without so much as a howdy-do. It's their good luck that I didn't kill one of them.
And yours. But it's bad enough. You'll have to get away from here.
I figured on that. I'll go hunting for a few days.
A few days? You'll have to be gone a lot longer than that. They won't be forgetting about you. If they find you, they'll chop you up into little pieces.
I didn't do nothing except defend myself. I didn't go charging into their camp.
This isn't Tennessee. You gotta put some country behind you, and the sooner the better.
James thought about the logs piled up for his cabin. He had hoped to move into it before winter's cold and stop depending so much upon Andrew and Petra.
But what about my farm? I don't want to give it up.
You want to be buried on it?
Maybe in 50 or 60 years.
It's not even a farm yet anyhow. It's just raw land. If it's not still vacant, there'll be another for you someplace when you get back.
From where?
I don't know. Home to Tennessee maybe for a year or so.
A year?
Till the soldiers have moved on somewhere else.
James felt as if Andrew had struck him in the stomach. A year seemed like a life sentence, especially in view of the fact that he hadn't been here nearly that long.
Maybe if I just go off for a long trip hunting. Maybe go west and see what San Antonio de Bar looks like.
Not Bar. That's where the soldiers are sent from. No, I think you better clear out of Texas for a while. Maybe over around Natchitoches, Louisiana, if you don't want to go all the way to Tennessee. Hey, you could probably find some work to do. Maybe old man Villaray, Marie's papa. Yeah, he might have something for you.
You're making a lot out of this, Andrew. It was the soldiers started it all.
And they'll finish it if you give them the chance.
James rode with his brother back to Andrew's place, resisting all the way, thinking up arguments. By the time they reached the cabin, he'd just about made up his mind not to go at all. They couldn't do anything to a man who'd acted only in self-defense. He expected Annie to wade into him with a lot of sisterly scolding, but she only stared at him with sad blue eyes that appeared about to break into tears at any moment. It was Petra, for once, who did the talking. She took both his hands in hers and told him of the terrible day the soldiers had killed her father, while her half-grown brothers stood by and could do nothing. The younger Moreno children, like herself, had huddled in terror with their mother inside their cabin. Andrew had already talked himself out. He could only stand and nod agreement with what Petra said.
If they come for you, James, it will be again as with my father. You will die here. And for what? For a pig?
It ain't just the pig. It's that a man ought to stand his ground and not run like a rabbit.
And what then? You stand your ground and you die on it. The soldiers win. They always win.
James turned to his sister.
Annie, I didn't want to bring you here in the first place, but I did it anyway. Now you want me to run off and leave you?
I want you alive. The rest doesn't matter.
Don't be fretting yourself over Annie. We'll take care of her. Me, Michael, and Petra and Marie.
Damn, then. They come already?
James looked toward the sound of the running horses and saw his brother Michael and someone else. A black-bearded man dismounted from a sweat-lathered sorrel. James had not seen much of the Blackwood family in his months here, but he remembered this one as Isaac. Isaac fixed James with a solemn stare.
You'd be the one they're after, I reckon.
Who's after me?
Them Mexican soldiers. I was over to the Willett place just now. There's a bunch of them soldiers there, taking their siesta and robbing the old lady's garden when three more of them rode in from this direction. One of them had his leg butchered up some. They was mighty mad. Best me and the Willett boy can make out from their talk. They had a run-in with some young buck over this way. They was fixing to come back and get him. I skint out and come by Michael's place. Didn't know but what you'd be there.
Michael had said nothing. He just stared at James with a sad look, much like Annie's. It struck James as odd that Michael would ride with a Blackwood under any circumstances.
Michael, everybody's wanting me to run away. I told them you wouldn't. You stand your ground and fight.
Tell him, Michael. Make him see he's got to go.
You never did run, Michael.
Run? You're damn right I've run. I found that there's a time to fight and there's a time to retreat. This is the time to run and run like hell.
James was conscious that the women had come out onto the dog run. They'd heard what Isaac and Michael said.
How many soldiers are there?
I'd expect there was a dozen. Maybe one or two more. More than you'd be wanting to tangle with, I'm thinking.
How far are they behind you, Isaac?
I can't rightly say, but not too far. I know how fast them soldiers' horses are.
You're a Blackwood. How come you'd want to warn me, a Lewis?
Isaac's gaze went for a moment to Annie, then lifted to the sky. A gray look had built up, clouds moving in from the Gulfway to the east, as if it might shortly rain.
It ain't gonna be no pretty day to die. If I was you, I'd be riding away from here mighty quick.
Petra turned back toward the kitchen.
James, I will put together something for you to eat. Andrew, you put together the things he will need.
James felt a chill, for the cold reality was finally sinking in. He was truly going. There was no choice. He still half expected Annie to blame him, to send him away with her recriminations ringing in his ears. But she put her arms around him, and he felt her tears wet against his cheek.
Please, James, don't let anything happen to you.
Petra came with a sack of food. Andrew tied James's rolled blankets behind the saddle and led the long-legged bay horse up to the dog run.
What clothes you got are inside the blankets.
Andrew went into the cabin's kitchen and came out again with a few coins in his hand.
It ain't much, because we don't have much, but maybe it'll see you through if you find yourself in need.
James thought he could see something moving on the eastern horizon, but it might have been the tears he was trying to force back.
I didn't go to bring trouble down on all y'all. All I intend to do was to stop a thief.
Just don't stop any bullets.
Michael, I wish I could say goodbye to your family. To Marie and Mordecai.
They'll understand.
Isaac Blackwood had been watching the horizon.
They're coming. Boy, was I you I'd skin out yonder way, across the river. Then stay in the timber, at least till night catches you. You know where our place is at?
James knew only vaguely he had not been there.
Well, Was I you, I'd go around. It'd be like Finnis to try and turn you in to get himself better fixed with the authorities.
I do thank you, Isaac.
James hugged Petra and then his brothers.
I don't know when, but I'll be back.
James turned to Annie. He touched her wet cheek with the palm of his hand.
I'll be all right, sis. And don't you go marrying the first old boy that comes along.
He swung up onto Walker, having to lift his leg high to clear the roll of blankets. He rode down to the river and put the horse into the water.
Ahí está! ¡Octelerel!
James could see the soldiers spurring hard to catch him. He leaned over Walker's neck to make himself less of a target. He tried to push the horse for more speed, but Walker was swimming, doing the best he could. The swimming speed was much less than the running speed on the ground, and the soldiers quickly closed the distance. Before James was out of the water on the north bank, some of the soldiers had put their mounts into it from the south. James felt like a mule had kicked him in the ribs, knocking most of the breath out of him. He almost fell from the saddle, grabbed and held on. He brought a hand up to his right side and felt blood there, warm and sticky. The wound burned as if it were being seared by a branding iron. The pain was sharp. The bullet had glanced off, but he suspected its impact had cracked a rib. His head swam. He wasn't sure he was going to be able to stay on the horse, but he had no choice. He sensed that those men back there had every intention of killing him. Self-defense didn't mean anything if a man never lived to get to the courtroom. He headed the horse into the heavy woods.
Come on, Walker. If you've ever had to win a race in your life, this one is it.
Pain shot through his body like a lance with each stride the horse made, but James held to the saddle and urged Walker to keep moving, dodging his way through the timber. The soft mat of old leaves left little or no track. In a while he stopped, partly for momentary relief from the pain, partly to listen. He heard no sound of pursuit. Somehow he had shaken loose from the soldiers, but James knew he had meandered in the woods. He'd not spent much time on this side of the river, so he didn't know his way. He let the horse move in a walk. That eased the jolting, afforded the horse a chance to recover its wind, and gave James a better chance to hear if the soldiers approached him again. He didn't know which direction was safest for him to travel. If the soldiers had gone around him, he faced the hazard that he might run into them again, no matter what direction he followed. The persistence of the pain and the slow but steady trickle of blood forced him finally to dismount and lie down on the ground. When he pressed his hand to his side, the sharp pain almost took his breath away. He remembered that once, when he was 12 or 13, he'd fallen from a horse and cracked a rib, possibly the same one the musket ball had struck. His mother had wrapped his rib cage tightly with cloth. That had given him some ease. But he had no cloth here, unless he were to tear up his homespun shirt or empty the bag of food Petra had given him. He was reluctant to do either. He thought of the rawhide rope he had used to drag logs to the cabin site. He pushed carefully to his feet and took it from the saddle. He found the process awkward because he had to keep circling the coiled rope around his body, shifting it from one hand to the other. Invariably, he lost its tautness and it slipped down to his waist in a tangle. Another idea came. He tied one end of the rope to a tree, backed off to the end of it, and began turning slowly in circles, keeping the rope tight, winding it around and around his body like a windlass as he moved closer to the tree. The overlapping coils prevented slippage. He tucked the end of the rope under them. It still hurt, but less intensively now. He felt as though his upper body was encased in a tight barrel, or he was stuck in a hollow log. It was a poor solution to the problem, but better than no solution at all. He found himself exhausted by the effort and lay flat on his back for a while, looking up at the heavy canopy that blocked out most of the sunlight. He let his mind run back over the events of the afternoon. He gave in to alternate bouts of regret and anger. Regret that he had been forced to leave his new home, his brothers and their families, even Annie. Anger over a mistaken government policy that sent convict soldiers to police honest people. It was like sending a wolf to guard the lambs. One frustrating conclusion kept coming to him, that there was not a damn thing he could do about it. He had done too much already. Right and wrong were no longer the immediate concern. Survival was. He rested as long as he dared, ate cold venison and bread from the sack Petra had given him, then remounted and set Walker in an easterly direction. Each time the trees thinned and he seemed to be coming to the edge of the woods, he drew in again. After dark, he would break out into the open and try for speed to put this place as far behind him as he could before daylight. Right now, concealment was his first concern. He came unexpectedly upon a clearing and a cabin. Caution told him to pull back into the timber and keep riding, but the wound had produced the beginnings of fever. His mouth was parched. He saw a stone-walled well 10 paces from the cabin. Seeing no sign of Mexican soldiers, he pushed Walker toward the well. He dismounted unsteadily, leaning against the circular stone wall for support. He began cranking the windlass, bringing up the bucket from the bottom. He sensed uneasily that he was being watched. He saw a boy peering with curiosity around the corner of the cabin. As they made eye contact, the boy quickly disappeared. As the bucket came to the top, James swung it out to rest on the flat top of the wall and eagerly dipped a drinking gourd that hung from one of the posts supporting the windlass. The water was cool and sweet and brought a sense of relief as he gulped down all the gourd could hold.
Hey, stranger! That's a private well.
James had trouble bringing his eyes to focus on the face. He rubbed an arm across them and saw two men, both black-bearded. The fatter of the two had but one arm. He carried a rifle in the other, cradling it across the stump. Dismay nearly took James's feet from under him as he realized he had done just what Isaac Blackwood had warned him against. He had blundered onto the Blackwood place. Finnis Blackwood looked at the rope wrapped around James's torso.
Who the hell tied you up? And how'd you get away?
Then his eyes narrowed as recognition slowly came to him.
My God, you look to me like a Lewis. You ain't Michael or Andrew. You got the look of them about you.
Yeah, it's a look of them, all right.
James remembered that folks said Luke was strong of body but weak in the head. He sensed that the best thing would be for him to get on Walker and ride.
Much obliged for the drink.
You got blood on you. By God, you've been shot. That's what it is.
Finnis brought the rifle to bear on James.
Luke, I know now what it was and Mexican soldiers was trying to tell us when they came up here a little while ago jabbering at us in Spanish. They was looking for somebody, and this here is him.
James put a foot in the stirrup. Finnis moved quickly for a fat man, jabbing the muzzle of the rifle against the rope that bound James's ribs.
You ain't a-going no place. You step back away from that horse without you want another bullet in you.
The man's muddy eyes told James that he meant it. James weighed his chance of kicking the rifle aside and knew it was poor. He was a Lewis. Finnis Blackwood would kill him without hesitation and be grateful for the opportunity. He eased his foot back to the ground.
I never done you any harm.
You're one of them. You come on over here to the house. Luke, you take his horse and turn him into the lot, and saddle mine. I'm gonna see if I can't find them soldiers.
What do you want the soldiers for?
They'd think a right smart better of us was we to catch this boy for him, wouldn't they? Might even give us more land, never can tell.
We ain't used up all we already got.
Land is money. Ain't never been no rich Blackwoods, we might just get to be the first ones.
You reckon they'll hang him?
I don't know. I ain't rightly sure what they want him for.
I ain't ever seen a hanging. I'd like to.
Maybe they'll give us an invite. Go do what I tell you. Now, you get along into that cabin.
It was a double cabin, like so many in the Austin colony, modeled after those back where most of the settlers had come from. A heavy woman stood with the boy in the open dog run. James couldn't tell whether she was pregnant or just fat. She wore an old homespun dress that fitted her like a sack, reaching down almost to her calloused feet. She stared with the same uncomprehending expression as Luke's. The boy appeared to be 5 or 6 years old. He had all the markings of the Blackwood boys James had known back in Tennessee, though his eyes looked brighter than most.
What are you doing with that feller, Finnis? What you got him all tied up for?
Somebody already tied him up before I got him. They left his arms out. Ain't no wonder he got away from them. But he ain't getting away from us.
Nellie studied James from his head down to his feet as if he were a stud horse or something.
He ain't a bad-looking feller. Nice and young. What would anyone want to tie him up for?
He's the one them soldiers was a-hunting. I'm gonna fetch him here and see what they'll give us for him.
They'll probably shoot him. Ain't good for the young'uns to see such as that.
This is a Lewis, and it'd do the young'uns good, let him see what life is all about.
He's been a-bleeding.
I ain't never seen a Lewis bleed enough to suit me.
Luke brought Finnis's horse.
Finnis, why don't you let me go after the soldiers?
Because you'd get lost in a mile, I'd have to go hunt you.
Finnis handed Luke the rifle.
Now don't you let him get away, or them soldiers will be mad at us instead of the Lewises.
Well, you want me to shoot him if he tries to leave?
That's what I gave you a rifle for, ain't it?
Seems like a shame. Him so young and handsome and all.
And don't you go getting no ideas about him. You already got man enough to take care of what you need. And that's me.
Always cussing me, he is. I got a mind to shoot this feller and see what Finney says about that.
You don't want to go and do nothing like that, Luke.
Nellie moved up close and touched the rawhide rope that bound James's ribs. Dried blood had seeped out through the shirt and the tight coils.
Poor boy. You've been hurt.
James tried to watch her, but found himself watching Luke's rifle.
Musket ball broke a rib, I think. The rope was all I had to bind it with.
You come on in to the house and I'll see what I can do for you. Ain't right leaving a man to stand out here and bleed to death.
James didn't think the wound was bleeding anymore, but he didn't argue.
What you fixing to do with him, Nellie?
See if I can patch him up.
Finnis wouldn't like that.
Finnis ain't here. You coming to help, or are you going to stand out here with your mouth hanging open?
I reckon I'll go in. Finnis told me to watch him.
She led James into the bedroom side of the double cabin. It was a Spartan hovel, to say the best for it. The fireplace at the east end was about as crudely put together as James had ever seen. He thought it a wonder that the cabin hadn't burned. The furniture was rough and splintery, homemade by careless hands. The floor was of dirt. James could remember living in a dirt-floored cabin when he was small, but at least his mother swept it every day. This one showed no experience with a broom. The woman motioned him toward a lopsided bed that was only a rawhide-tied timber frame and a corn-shuck mattress.
Have yourself a sit-down. Let's get that rope off of you and see what you look like.
He saw two more children, one a boy of about two or so, the other a baby lying asleep in a crib. It seemed to him that Nellie rubbed her hands against him a lot in the process of removing the rawhide rope. She leaned so near that he could smell her breath and feel the warmth that emanated from her large body.
Ain't no fat on your ribs at all. You're thinner than a hard-wintered pony.
When the rope all lay on the packed dirt floor, she pulled his cotton shirt up to just beneath his armpits. She looked at him a minute, and he was not sure he liked what he saw in her eyes. It was hunger of a sort.
You kind of put me in mind of Isaac. He never was one for no extra weight, neither. I always kind of liked the man that was all muscle.
She rubbed her hand over his chest and his rib cage, ranging far beyond just the spot torn and angry from the bullet. She pushed gently against the hurt rib.
Well, that hurt, didn't it? Rib ain't busted in two, but I don't doubt that it's cracked.
Nellie cleansed the wound with corn whiskey, which made James want to climb the log wall for a minute until the fire burned down.
Well, that's our drinking whiskey.
Nellie ignored him and took her time washing the area around the wound, her hands moving slowly, caressing. She dried him with a piece of cloth, taking her time about that too. From a box, she took more homespun cotton cloth and bound James's ribs. The cloth was more comfortable than the rawhide rope had been, but her hands worried him. They moved up above the binding and down to his leg where he had not been hurt. James had not had much experience with women, but it was clear to him that her interest went beyond any nursing instinct. He wasn't sure how to respond.
Luke, why don't you go outside and keep a watch for Finnis?
Well, he knows his way home.
Take the jug with you, and the two boys. You three can play games.
What about this feller? Who's gonna watch him?
I'll do that. Now you all get. This man needs his rest before the soldiers come.
You're sure this is the way Finnis would want it?
Finnis ain't here to say otherwise.
As Luke and the boys went out the door, she closed it and slid a wooden bar into place. She turned back toward James, and he knew he didn't like the look in her eyes. She studied him as if she were a bear and he was a chunk of red meat. She sat down beside him on the edge of the bed. Her hand went to his leg.
You a married man?
No.
I didn't much think so. You look a little young yet for that. But you never can tell. They get to wanting what a woman's got for them. They sometimes marry awful young.
Nellie's hand began moving suggestively up and down his leg.
It's a pity how many bachelors there is in this country that don't have no idea how good a woman can be. How's that binding feel?
It hurts some. I think I need some air.
James tried to get up from the bed, but she put an arm around his shoulder and held him.
What you need is to lay down a while. Rest easy.
What I really need is to get away from here before them soldiers come back. They're set to kill me.
Nellie kept her hand moving.
That'd be a waste, sure enough. Ain't near enough good-looking man in this country as it is. Yes, sir. Sure would be a waste. You really one of them Lewises?
From across the river.
I never did rightly know how come Finnis hates the Lewises so much. What little I ever seen of Michael and Andrew, they seemed like good men. Handsome, too, the both of them. Always kind of wished I'd seen them before Finnis come along.
James tried to imagine Nellie in Michael's or Andrew's cabins instead of Marie or Petra. He would have laughed were he not so ill at ease.
And how come you to marry Finnis?
Had to marry somebody. The baby was coming on. Isaac never asked me, and Luke, he ain't bright. Never was sure which one of them was rightfully the baby's papa. But I reckon it don't make no difference. We're all family anyway. It's like they was all my husbands.
All of them?
Well, Isaac don't do me no more. Mostly it's Finnis, and now and again Luke when Finnis ain't around. Ain't neither one of them very good looking. Not like you, anyway.
She kissed him boldly.
I wouldn't mind a change if you was willing.
Nellie had both arms around him. He felt trapped, smothering in her heavy embrace. He knew her aim was seduction, but his reaction was nearer panic than arousal.
Please, my ribs.
She relaxed her hold.
I didn't go to hurt you none. Almost forgot for a minute. I reckon you don't feel up to doing nothing right now.
James took advantage of the moment to free himself from her and get to his feet.
No, ma'am. I'm afraid I'm hurt too much.
Well, maybe another time, if you get away from the soldiers.
I don't know how I'm gonna do that when Luke's waiting outside with that rifle.
That won't be no trouble. Luke's half drunk by now and probably forgot what Finnis told him to do. You just stand by the door and when Luke comes in, you slip out right quiet. I'll keep him busy for a while.
I'm obliged to you, ma'am.
It ain't no strain. I've gotten the mood anyway. Since it can't be you, Luke'll do.
I don't know how I can ever pay you.
You can come back around someday when Luke and Finnis ain't here and when there ain't no soldiers after you. Like I said, there just ain't enough good-looking men in this country.
Nellie lifted the bar and opened the door while James coiled the rope.
Luke, you want to come in here?
What for?
I just want you to. Finnis ain't here. Been a while since it was just me and you without Finnis around.
Oh, that's a fact.
Luke blinked at James as if he'd forgotten about him.
Hey, wasn't we supposed to be guarding this feller?
He's a growed man.
Nellie took the rifle from Luke's hand and leaned it against the rough wall. She took Luke's hand and brought it around behind her.
Let him take care of himself.
James stepped outside. The older of the two boys stared up at him. James tried to decide which Blackwood he resembled most. He guessed it was as Nellie had said. It didn't make much difference. He tousled the boy's hair.
You take good care of your mama, young'un. Ain't many like her around.
He hurried to the lot, saddled Walker, and set him into a slow but steady lope, putting this place behind him. He forgot, until he was a mile or two away, that his ribs still hurt. He rode most of the night, stopping occasionally to rest. The tight binding Nellie had wrapped around his ribs was more effective than the crude one he had formed with the rawhide rope, but it didn't block all the pain. He tried not to think about what he was leaving behind, but the image of it kept running through his mind over and over. Maybe if he had listened to Andrew more, maybe if he hadn't been so quick to antagonize the damned sergeant, maybe if... The maybes went on and on. The frustration hurt almost as much as his cracked rib. Well, he wouldn't stay gone. They could count on that. He'd be back to reclaim what belonged to him. Michael's first experience in Texas had been disastrous, but he had come back. For James to do less would be to fail his older brother. He avoided well-traveled trails and roads, crossing the Brazos and skirting north of where he knew San Felipe to be. But as he sensed that he was nearing the edge of the Austin colony, the sharp pangs of regret deepened. He wished to delay that final separation as long as he dared. Because of last spring's trip down from Nacogdoches, he knew that when he left the Austin colony, he was likely to travel for days without seeing so much as a farmhouse. The food Petra had hastily sacked for him was gone. He saw a farmer and several young boys gathering corn in a field neatly fenced with rails. The long, rambling log house, the pens, and the sheds reflected relative prosperity. This was probably one of Stephen F. Austin's original 300, here long enough now to have set his roots deeply in the rich soil of this new land. James felt reasonably confident that he had temporarily outdistanced pursuit or any word of his fugitive status. He argued with himself only a little before he turned Walker's head away from the woods and over toward the field. The wound hadn't bled since he had been at the Blackwood place, and he'd rinsed all the blood from the shirt. The bullet hole remained. He reasoned that these people probably wouldn't notice it. Clothes worn and torn, even ragged, were common in this fledgling colony. Reality and practicality took precedence over form and fashion. He raised his hand in greeting as the middle-aged farmer trudged down a row of head-high corn to the rail fence. The boys had stopped working, staring at James with curiosity.
How do? Light and rest a spell.
The farmer had rusty-colored hair and a round, happy-looking face, red both from his nature and from exposure to the Texas sun.
I'm obliged.
James motioned toward a cloth-wrapped water jug hanging from the fence.
Mind if I have a swig of that? Been a long way since the last creek.
Help yourself and welcome. You heading for Nacogdoches?
That direction, anyway.
James intended to swing south of Nacogdoches and hit the Sabine River in some isolated area where he was unlikely to encounter soldiers. Sergeant Diaz there was almost sure to remember him, as much trouble as they'd given one another last spring.
You boys get back to work. You don't look well fixed for a ride that long. I see blankets, but I see nothing in the way of victuals.
Got my rifle. Figured I'd find enough game along the way. Had squirrel last evening.
Getting toward noonday. My wife and the girls will be ringing the bell for dinner pretty soon. It's plain, but there's always a plenty if you care to stop with us for a spell.
James looked behind him. He didn't expect to see soldiers, but one never could be sure. His stomach reminded him that none of the squirrel had survived last night's supper, and breakfast had consisted of the last piece of dry bread from Petra's sack.
My horse could stand a rest. We've been traveling pretty hard.
I hate to say this, but you got the look of a man who's watching back over his shoulder. That hole in your shirt looks like it could have been made by a rifle ball. You running from somebody?
To tell you the truth, sir, I run afoul of some Mexican convict soldiers. I had to up and leave what was rightfully mine. You seen any soldiers over this way?
They taking what they wanted and then left. I figured it was better to let them. I just look on it as an extra tax.
I guess that was my brother Andrew's way of looking at it, but it wasn't mine.
Andrew? Would that be Andrew Lewis? Seems like I see a resemblance now that I look at you a little closer.
You're right, sir. I'm James Lewis.
A good man, that Andrew.
Michael's my brother, too.
I've met Michael, but he's a hard man to get to know. Andrew, now. But if you're a brother of Andrew Lewis, you're more than welcome at this place. I'm Marcus Caldwell. Them yonder's my boys.
I gotta tell you, sir, there's a chance a soldier will come looking for me.
You kill one of them?
Priest one a little is all. Caused another one to fall on his sword and stick it in his leg. It acted like it was a killing.
A mistaken policy sending convict soldiers here. But Austin has gone to Mexico to talk to the officials. He's always been able to get things straightened out.
I hope he hurries.
The log house, like many James had seen in the colony, showed the rambling effect of several additions as the family had grown. The whole place had a well-tended look, a look that indicated comfort, as comfort was measured in the relative isolation of the Austin colony from the old states back home. It reminded him of Widow Willett's place, some distance east of Michael's. These people had dug in here to stay. He found that at least one of the boys had overheard his conversation with Caldwell about his trouble with the soldiers. Caldwell's wife stood on the narrow porch, waiting for her husband and the company her sons had told her was coming.
Martha, this here is another one of the Lewis boys, brother to Andrew. You remember Andrew.
Name is James, ma'am. I'm mighty pleased to meet you.
Her response was to touch his shirt, examining the hole left by the musket ball.
If you'd like to put on one of Marcus's shirts, I'll patch this for you right after dinner. The boys didn't say if you were wounded.
Nothing to talk about, ma'am. I reckon the ball was pert nigh spent by the time it struck me.
A girl with red hair stood half a pace behind her mother. James took her to be about 15 or so, and some plainer than a few girls he'd known back in Tennessee. She seemed not impressed by him.
What if the soldiers come looking while he's here? They won't take it kindly, us feeding him.
He's a brother of Andrew Lewis. If the soldiers are after him, it's the soldiers who are wrong.
But they're the ones with the guns. Maybe we ought to just give him something to take with him and let him be on his way. If they catch him, let it be somewhere else.
They won't catch him while he's here because somebody's going to watch and give warning if they come. Since you're the one most worried about it, Libby Caldwell, that's a fit and proper job for you.
Ma'am, I don't want to be no trouble. Not to you and not to this little girl here.
James saw a flash of resentment in Libby's blue eyes over the little girl reference.
There'll be no trouble. Libby can eat when somebody else is done and can take her place.
Martha's manner showed that the subject was closed. James shrugged at the girl and went inside. The girl's eyes indicated that he had not made a friend. The house was of logs, but it was well finished inside. He looked at the fine stonework in the fireplace and remembered the haphazard one he'd seen in the Blackwood cabin. The homemade furniture was plain, probably done by Caldwell and his sons, but it indicated care, skill, and time. What this family had, they had built for themselves and built well. The food on the table was plain, as Caldwell had said, but it was plentiful, including fresh corn roasted in the ear and pork from the family's own free-ranging herd of hogs. The sons and daughters were seated on benches along the length of the table, girls on one side, boys on the other. The mother and father took chairs at either end. The oldest of the boys appeared to be around 16 or 17.
Mr. Davis down at the Forks of the Creek says we're going to have to fight Mexico one of these days and show them they can't boss Americans around.
Hush with that kind of talk, Thomas. Mexicans let us come here and take up land and own it. We can look to Mr. Austin to watch out for our interests. Us talking too much will just make that job harder for him.
But Mr. Lewis here, he didn't let them boss him around. I'll bet Mr. Davis would sure like to meet him.
Well, you see, it's because I resisted and I'm running for my life right now. My brother Andrew agreed with your papa. If I'd listened to him, I wouldn't be in this fix.
And you'd be short a pig. Maybe a bunch of pigs. I wish I could have shot at them.
Thomas! We'll have no seditious talk in this house. It can only lead to trouble.
James saw in this family a diversity of opinion that he suspected was growing all over the Austin colony and probably in the other American settlements. He also saw that his presence here was fueling the disagreement between father and son. He thought he had eaten enough. He pushed away from the table and stepped back from the bench.
I'm mighty obliged for the good dinner, but I better be moving on.
Well, I was going to mend your shirt.
The shirt'll be all right. I'll do it myself when I get past the Sabine.
Mrs. Caldwell gathered up some of the food left on the table and began putting it into a sack.
Well, it's a long ways to Louisiana. I'll not let you leave here without you take something along to eat.
Caldwell stood up and shook James's hand.
I'll find some way to get word back to your brothers that you passed this way and that you were all right.
That'd be more than kind of you, sir.
James paused to look at this family. They reminded him a lot of the Lewises back in Tennessee, of his mother, of Uncle Benjamin, and all the rest. They gave him a feeling almost of being home. He hated to leave.
I'm glad to have met you folks. I hope I'll see you again someday, without any soldiers behind me.
James had unsaddled Walker in a pen with plenty of water, and Caldwell had given the horse some heads of maize in a trough. The maize had been eaten, and Walker nosed at the water without drinking. He had had his fill. James caught him and began to put his saddle on him. The red-haired Libby watched him through the rails of the corral fence.
You already fixing to leave? Thought you'd probably spend the rest of the day and somebody'd have to stand guard to keep the soldiers from catching you.
You can go in and eat now.
Libby pointed her chin at the sack of food Mrs. Caldwell had gathered up.
I'm surprised you left me anything.
I didn't ask you to stand guard for me. That was your mama's idea. Now go on in yonder and eat your dinner like I said.
I'll go when I'm ready. You don't boss me around.
Libby reminded him of his sister Annie. Not in looks, but in manner and sharpness of tongue. He finished the saddling, opened the gate, and swung up onto Walker.
I hope we'll meet again someday.
We won't. Unless you catch me unawares.
He remembered no particular landmarks from the trip the previous spring. Texas, that part of it anyway, had no mountains or even any sizable hills that might set themselves firmly in his mind. It had been a succession of forests, rolling open lands, cane breaks, streams, and rivers without any particularly distinguishing characteristics. It was a feeling rather than any tangible evidence that told him he was nearing the eastern edge of Texas. If he had ever crossed over the track they had followed before, he wasn't aware of it. But he came at last to a trail that appeared to have carried some horse or mule traffic at times in the past, though it revealed no sign of recent use. It led him almost due eastward. He wasn't sure how far the Sabine lay ahead, probably a few miles. James spotted a squirrel and thought it might be a good idea to prepare for dinner, either on this side of the river or on the Louisiana side. Suddenly, in the distance, James noticed the presence of four Mexican soldiers. They quartered toward him out of the late afternoon sun. They had probably heard the shot and come to investigate. They pushed their horses in a stiff trot. A patrol out of Nacogdoches, he figured, watching for smugglers or illegal immigrants. Surely they had not had time to hear about his trouble down in the colony, but chances were they would take him to Nacogdoches for investigation, and that bloodhound Diaz would find out.
Come on, Walker. Let's see how good their horses are.
In the distance, the soldiers tried to keep up, but their horses were of mediocre quality. They presented no great challenge. The run was shorter than he had dared hope. The river appeared unexpectedly. Remembering how Walker's slow swimming in the Colorado had given pursuing soldiers a chance to get within firing distance, he pushed for all the speed he could get to widen the distance before they reached the water. The soldiers trailed by at least 200 or 300 yards when James paused to look behind him at the Texas he had entered so eagerly last spring, not once, but twice.
It's a damn shame to be leaving it now. Well, I'll be coming back.
Across the river and well up on the Louisiana bank, James could see a small cabin, its old logs almost orange-colored in the last moments of the setting sun. He swam the horse across, holding his rifle high to keep it from getting wet. On the Louisiana side, he dismounted again and let Walker shake off some of the water. The soldiers had reached the river's edge and stopped there, watching him. At the distance, he couldn't see their expressions, but he presumed they were of frustration. For that, he was duly thankful. He looked up toward the cabin. He couldn't see if it was occupied. No matter, it was shelter. Thunderheads were building in the east. Like as not, it was going to rain tonight. At least it had not rained on him during the days and nights of his retreat across Texas. Let it rain the bottom out now for all he cared. This was not his country. He might be obliged to remain here a while, but Texas had become his country, and it would remain so no matter where he had to go. He led the horse up the long, high bank to a shed and set of log pens that looked familiar. He had been here, by here anyway, last spring. He saw two Spanish dagger plants flanking a white locust tree and remembered. This had been old Eli Pleasant's place. From here, Eli had conducted his smuggling operations into and out of Texas, between Natchitoches, Louisiana, and the Nacogdoches region. James had struck the old smuggler trail and had followed it. He put Walker in the pen and found some corn for him in a wooden barrel beneath the shed. The trip had drawn the horse down some. He had traveled hard and had not had time to graze enough. Well, James had no plans now. He would stay here a few days and let the horse rest. Eli had been a good friend to the Lewises. He would have approved. Wearily, James walked to the cabin, looking up at the chimney, but seeing no sign of smoke. He had held on to the squirrel, whose demise had attracted the soldiers. It would make him a good supper. Round in the corner of the cabin, he was startled to see a man standing there, waiting for him. James's hands tightened on his rifle until he recognized the face.
I thought you was fixing to bring them soldiers on over here. They ain't quite the kind of company I need.
Sly Shipman.
James recovered quickly from his surprise. After all, this was Shipman's cabin, informally inherited from Eli Pleasant. At least his claim on it was probably as good as anybody's.
I expect they've chased you across that river plenty of times.
I never expected to see you again, James Lewis. I figured somebody'd have shot you before now.
You're always figuring and figuring wrong.
What did you do to get the soldiers after you? Did you punch Sergeant Diaz in the face or something?
Shipman listened to the explanation with more sympathy than James had expected.
What you going to do now? Fugitive or not, a man has got to eat.
I brought a squirrel for supper.
I'm figuring farther down the road than just supper. I'm figuring next week, next winter, and on past that.
I ain't had time to sort things out. Getting to this side of the river was my main worry. Now that I'm here, I'll have to figure out what my next step is going to be.
Shipman studied him until James became uneasy under the young man's solemn gaze. He felt that Shipman was looking through him, plumb to the gizzard.
I know me and you didn't get along very good when we met before. We may not get along good now, because it strikes me that you still jump first and think about it later. But I could use some help, if you'd like to join up with me.
Doing what?
Being a merchant to the people. Whatever needs selling, we sell. Whatever needs buying, we buy.
Smuggling, you mean?
I was right. You ain't changed a bit. If I had any sense, I wouldn't even ask you.
But you did ask me. Now I've got nothing better to do.
Shipman nodded. The matter settled.
Yeah. You said something about supper?
The squirrel was reduced to a stack of bones on the rough table. The two men leaned back in a pair of crude chairs. Shipman lighted up a long black cheroot. James eyed him with curiosity.
Shipman, you say yourself you don't especially like me. You could get somebody else to help you. Why'd you ask me?
How's that good-looking sister of yours?